Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
I must say that I had a great help from John Landis, because one of the first comedy I did with John was, of course, Animal House. And when John showed me the film, I said, why me, John? Get this. So John said, well, I have an idea, a particular idea. I said, what's the idea? He said, I don't want you to – how about you do a score that has nothing to do with comedy? You treat this as if it were a drama, you know. So I thought, well, that's interesting. And that's what we did. And, you know, if you listen to the main title of Animal House, it's Brahms, you know. It's really something out of the Academic Festival Overture, you know, kind of thing. And the effect was actually very funny. It was a very funny effect. Serious music, funny things going on.
Now, tonight, the RTE Concert Orchestra will be in the National Concert Hall for a night called Elmer Bernstein, 50 Years of Film Music. And the orchestra will be in great company. To conduct will be Elmer's son, Peter Bernstein. And the MC is someone you heard reference to in that clip, who's worked with Elmer on many films, the film director John Landis. John, good afternoon to you.
Hello.
It's a funny thing about Elmer Bernstein, his career, in that he's such a well-known name, but he seems to have experienced periods in his career where he was either the comedy guy or he wasn't the comedy guy, and he couldn't be seen to be the rounded composer that he was.
Well, he didn't become Mr. Comedy till way late in his career. Mm. That's my fault, I guess, because after Animal House, he did many more films for me, Trading Places, Three Amigos, many movies. But he also did Airplane and Ghostbusters and Stripes. I mean, he did the biggest comedies of all time. But Elmer started his career. He actually got in a niche. He was Mr. Epic, you know, the Ten Commandments, Hawaii.
Yeah.
And then he did a jazz score, which was revolutionary. The Man with the Golden Arm, Otto Preminger's film with Sinatra. Mm. There had been jazz in scores, but that's an entirely jazz score. And it was so radical, he became Mr. Jazz. Which, you know, Elmer is a classically trained composer. He studied with Aaron Copland, and suddenly he's Mr. Jazz. He did Sweet Smell of Success, and
Yeah, there's a long list of very classic movies that.
Trying to think of another jazz movie, which has just gone out of my head. But he wanted to do a Western, and no one would hire him for a Western because he was Mr. Jazz. And then, of course, he did Magnificent Seven, which most people still can hum. And so he then ended up doing 10 John Wayne movies, including True Grit.
Yeah.
He had such a wide breadth of career. He did To Kill a Mockingbird, Birdman of Alcatraz. I mean, so many different kinds of films. There's an Irish producer named Noel Pearson.
Yeah.
And he was kind of a hustler at the time, promoter. And he made a deal with Elmer Bernstein and Henry Mancini to come to Dublin and do a concert of motion picture music. And when they arrived, Noel had sort of forgotten to get a venue. So he was able to get, he was quite happy. He told Elmer, listen, I've got a hall, but we can only have it from midnight on. Mm. And Elmer said, starting at midnight? He goes, yes. And I go, what the hell do I tell Henry? He says, tell him it's an Irish tradition. But they did it. It was a huge success. And Noel became great friends with Elmer, and Elmer said, you know, Noel, you do theater, but one day if you do a movie, I'll score it for free. And many years later, Elmer got a call from Noel Pearce, and he says, I'm doing a movie. You owe me a free movie. My Left Foot.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. I can guarantee you, though, John, there will be a hall tonight. They have set it up. I've worked with these people before. They're quite reliable.
Oh,
and the National Concert Hall is absolutely lovely. That clip that we played at the start kind of reminded me of that old cliche about comedy is tragedy plus time. That was that in your mind when you told him, just, you know, make it epic sounding? That makes it funnier.
No, I just wanted him to play the comedy. No matter how outrageous things get on screen, I like to play them very, this is going to sound bizarre, but as real as possible.
Mm.
So if you're doing a, you score it as if it's a dramatic scene, because for the characters on screen, it is dramatic, you know.
Yeah.
You play it. And it, of course, that really was a terribly influential score. It's the way comedy's scored now. Comedy was always scored comedically. It was called wah-wah music.
Yes.
And, I mean, speaking of Henry Mancini, his brilliant score for the Pink Panther, that's funny music.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
And Elmer really changed that. And it's become a style, actually.
Yeah. And I want to actually go back to some of your work, because An American Werewolf in Paris.
In London.
So
I had nothing
to do with
the
Paris one. So pardon my slip there.
I just took a check for it.
Yeah.
I had nothing to do with that movie.
But An American Werewolf in London.
Thank you.
Was very different in the sense that I couldn't remember a movie that was genuinely funny but genuinely scary both at the same time.
Well, my intention was, I wanted to treat something totally impossible as real.
Yeah.
So therefore, what do you do when something that cannot exist is standing in front of you? It has to do with, if you and a mate go to a movie, this is the example I tried to sell that movie for so many years. It was thrown in my face, that script. But if you and a friend go to see a movie and you had a good time and you're coming out of the theater and you think, well, we'll go to the pub, and your friend nudges you and says, look at that guy. And across the street is a man, 6'4". He's wearing a tuxedo and a purple velour cape with satin lining.
Mm.
And he's got this big pompadour greased back and white pancake makeup and red lipstick and eyeliner. And he comes up to you and he says, good evening, I want to drink. Do you see what you're doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so if he grabs you and bites you on the throat, rips your throat out, and drinks your blood, and you're lying dying in the gutter, well, here's what happens. Shock, pain, surprise, but not once. You die. Not once do you think a vampire is eating me.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't happen. So a sophisticated person's response is to do exactly what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the movie's funny, because the lead characters are smart and they're reacting to something that can't happen.
Yeah, but there were scenes, like I always remember the scenes where he's transforming into a werewolf. And it's funny and
it's horrific.
It's horrific what's happening to him, but there's bits of it where his feet start growing and you start laughing as well. We were aware of the kind of tempo of that.
Yeah, but I mean, the classic, I don't know what you call it, actually, if there's a word for it, but there's something everybody does, which is if you're alone at night on a, you know, street and you hear a sound that's not right, you look over your shoulder and go, you know, that sort of nervous, but you laugh.
Yeah.
And the comedy, and see, I think An American Werewolf is a horror film, and my intention is to make a monster movie. And yes, it's very funny.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be very funny.
Well, half of the laughs are nervous laughs.
But it's not. I don't think it's a comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was the thing that was unusual about it. It's kind of a hybrid movie. That I suppose in this century there have been a few horror movies that have laughs in them, but generally horror movies don't have laughs in them.
Well, since Werewolf, there have been actually quite a few.
Yeah.
I mean, Peter Jackson made Brain Dead, and Sam Raimi made Evil Dead 2. I mean, there have been some wonderful ones. Edgar Wright did, what's it called? Oh, Simon Pegg, help me. The zombie movie.
Yeah. The one, the Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
That's a wonderfully funny movie.
Yeah.
About flesh eating.
Yes. Which is a hilarious subject in any circumstance. In filming in London in those days, was this kind of the, from reading about it, the impression I got, you just kind of turn up, well, can we film here and use a bit of charm?
In 1981, there was no film commission. There was nothing like that. And what had happened was a British director named Michael Winner. He made a movie in the 60s called The Jokers with Oliver Reed and Michael Crawford and Orson Welles about stealing the crown jewels. And without permission, he set off a smoke bomb in a taxi in Piccadilly Circus. And that was the height of the IRA bombings, and it shut the city down.
Yeah.
And Metropolitan Police basically said, that's it, fuck off, no more. There was no more filming in London. And so what it meant was it was down to the Bobby on the beat. So you were sure to feed them very well and keep them happy. But in fact, that's a British film. It's the last Edie picture.
Yeah. Yes.
And,
yeah.
You know, Margaret Thatcher was busy driving a stake through the heart of the film industry. But in any, I'm happy to say it's back. But in any case, meaning I had to have a British crew. I mean, it's a British film. So I'll never forget that I was hiring production managers and people would come in. That's an essential job. And people would come in and they've read the script and I would say, well, what do you think? And they'd go, well, I'm afraid you're not going to be able to do Piccadilly Circus. I mean, there's no way one after another was, nope, sorry, Governor. Nope, nope. And a woman named Joyce Hurley, who was maybe in her late 60s and then early 70s, she sat across and I said, well, so Joyce, what do you think about the script? Oh, I liked it. Which was unusual. And I said, oh, great. Any questions? No. And I said, well, did you think it'll be okay shooting? Oh, sure. So I said, well, what about Piccadilly Circus? And she said, we'll figure it out.
Great.
And I said, you're hired. Yes.
And you had been planning this film for such a long time that by the time you got to film in London, it had changed, especially bits of the West End.
Well, the only difference between this screenplay that I wrote in 1969 and the movie I made in 1981 was there used to be around London these things called cartoon cinemas where they would show cartoons and newsreels and commercials, and it was where parents would drop the kids off when they went on the high street kind of thing. And there was one in Victoria Station and one in Leicester Square and the Arrow Cinema in Piccadilly. And I, in 1975, I was the first time I worked in London for some time. I'm one of the many writers of a picture called The Spy Who Loved Me, James Bond movie. And so I was in London for a long time. And I would go – this is before home video. So I would go to these cinemas because they showed beautiful 35-millimeter prints of Tex Avery and Chuck Jones. I mean, just great cartoons that you couldn't see then. So I would – they thought I was crazy. But I would go to the cartoon cinemas, and I went to the Arrow Cinema quite a bit. And so when I wrote the script, the Arrow Cinema showed cartoons, and what was on screen in that sequence was a Roadrunner cartoon. And it was exact same sequence. It was just that it was a cartoon. And then when the people come up at the end and he shouts, run, that wasn't a man. It was children. So I finally get the money. I'd made enough movies that were successful that I was able to trick people and get the money. And I go to London. And they're porno theaters.
Yes.
It was like, oh, they're porno theaters. So I looked into maybe buying some porno stuff, but I watched a lot of the British Whoops My Knickers, you know, kind of the window cleaner drops his pants kind of movies. And they're so terrible. I said, yeah, fuck it, I'll make my own.
Yeah. And even the theater itself was called See You Next Wednesday.
No, not the theater. It that was the film.
That was in the film, yeah.
That was the title of the film. Yeah. The theater was the Arrow's theater.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, if you go there now, it's a Gap store.
Ah, right, okay. God, I don't know which I'm more depressed about. Actually, the other thing about American Werewolf in London, because I was a young developing man when I first saw it, was Jenny Agutter in a shower, which I want to thank you for.
I have to tell you, I work a lot in the UK, and, well, first of all, having made a lot of movies, depending on where you are, it's either Thriller or Animal House or Trading Places or the Blues Brothers, it's different in different countries. But in the UK and Ireland, it's definitely American Werewolf, and 90% of the men say to me, I want to thank you for Jenny Agutter. I mean, apparently that was a seminal moment in British history.
That, no pun intended, or perhaps intended there. Are you aware of a TV show called Call the Midwife?
Jenny, absolutely.
Yeah, she's
Jenny,
a nun now. You don't know how disturbing
no,
I find
wife,
that.
My wife and Jenny are best friends, Deborah, and she said Jenny's a genius. She turns 60 and she gets a job where she wears a wimple.
Yeah. lots of texts coming in. Frankie says, I love the Blues Brothers so much. I have two cats. They're called Elwood and Jake. They're very cool cats, says Frankie.
Don't let them drive.
What a film legend John Landis is. My favorite movie is The Blues Brothers. And the great quote, it's 106 miles to Chicago. We've got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark. And we're wearing sunglasses. And Tom in Limerick says, my family owned a cinema and I grew up listening to great film scores. To this day, I clearly recall Elmer Bernstein's amazing music to John B. Keane's The Field blaring through our little cinema.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, Elmer loved Ireland. He used to come quite a lot.
It should be a fantastic night tonight in the National
Concert Hall. We're playing some extraordinary music. And Peter's a great conductor. You know, Peter and I went to school together. In fact, Elmer Bernstein, when I was 15 years old, Mr. Bernstein took me and Peter and his brother Greg to see the Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl.
Cool.
So he's not only a great composer, he's a wonderful man.
Yeah. And actually, finally, I'll just read out one. Mary says, what a voice John Landis has. I'm weak at the knees listening to him.
Your number, Mary?
She must get that. Oh, we have it outside. We'll let you know it afterwards.
I've never heard that before.
Have you never heard that before?
I've never heard
really,
that before.
Really? You have a gorgeous voice. If my mind wasn't filled with images of Jenny Agutter in the shower, I'd be, you know. I'd be changing my mind.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. Don't be. You're an attractive man. John Landis, thanks a million for coming in to us. You'll be at the National Concert Hall tonight. We're going to take a break. After that, our farming slot.
It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes, it's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.